1994 classic from the Newsboys. 12 years old, doesn't get much better than that. Okay, today we want to talk about Song of Songs, which is comparable to the Holy of Holies, which means kind of an emphasis. Holy of Holies is the holiest place. Song of Songs is supposed to be the best song. And you might wonder why in the world we would spend time listening... Why we would spend time listening to Solomon talk about something like this, where obviously he was so messed up. But the same thing is probably true, you know, when it comes to the Proverbs as well. The rest of Solomon's life was messed up as well, and yet we still take the good things that he taught us in Proverbs as clearly inspired by God and given to us as a gift. And I think the same thing is true here. He certainly did do it wrong a lot of ways in his marriages. He got it wrong, but evidently knows some wisdom as well. So let's pray together and dive in, okay? Let's pray. Well, thanks again for this day. Thank you for a little bit of a break, and thank you for the opportunity to sit back and to enjoy and to focus upon what you have done for us. And Father, I pray that there'd be a natural humility that comes from that, that we would just stop thinking about ourselves so much and think a little bit more about you and about other people. I pray that would be part of what happens today as well, Father, in this area where sexuality is such a great gift from you. It's certainly one of those areas where Satan would want to twist it and make it a very selfishly oriented thing, and certainly it has been in our culture and perhaps in many of our lives. And I pray, Lord, that this would be a day, a new day, a day to think a little bit differently about some of the good gifts you've given to us. So we ask your blessing on us today. Help us to understand. Help us not to tune out, but to really to listen in to the message you have and then want to speak to us for your glory and for our good. So we pray that today in Jesus' name. Amen. Song of Songs. Always the day you hope doesn't show up on Grandparents' Day. Although it has before, it's really kind of interesting because the grandparents come up afterwards and say, you know, with little grins in their faces and say, yeah, that was really good, you know. But that's okay. If you're visiting today and you're here with us, recognize that we have gotten to know each other over this last semester, and we speak fairly frankly and directly to each other. So just hold on to your seats, okay? Because today we want to talk about, you know, what this is about. We want to talk about, you know, yeah, sex. There, we said it, okay? This book is one of God's good gifts to us. So let's take a look at it, Solomon's finest work. And there have been a spectrum of views over church history that have moved from the left side to the right side. Let me explain it to you very briefly. Allegory is probably the first way that many people have encountered this book. When we say an allegory, we're talking about this, that it is a reference not to what you think it's a reference to, but rather to Christ and the church. So those little phrases like catch for us, little foxes that ruin the vineyard, are references to sins, you know, that can corrupt your spiritual life. And when it says he is altogether lovely, it's talking about Christ's figure. So you tell me, as you read through this book, and hopefully you did it last night or over the weekend, as you read through the book, did your mind naturally flow to things like Christ and the church?
No.
No, probably not. Why would someone ever think this was a reference to Christ and the church? Help me out there. What's the logic involved? How in the world could you think this is Christ and the church?
John? The church is supposed to be Christ's bride.
The church is supposed to be Christ's bride. There are some, you know, probably some superficial parallels there. That's true. But I think it's something a little deeper than that psychologically. What do you suppose it is? What do you think? Presupposition that sex is bad, right? It certainly is not holy, right? If you have to have it, you know, you kind of sequester it in a separate part of your life you don't talk about because, okay, maybe it's necessary evil, but certainly not holy, not a gift from God. So we wouldn't want to, you know, give people the wrong impression. And that kind of, I don't want to say puritanical because the Puritans get blamed for a lot of things they don't really come up with, but that kind of pharisaical, perhaps, attitude has led to a lot of confusion, a lot of trouble in approaching it correctly. How many times have you heard a message on Song of Solomon in your church? See? So, let's move on beyond the allegory, and let's talk about this one. Some people say it is simply a celebration of physical love in marriage, and I think, yeah, it probably is that in some ways, but what are they really saying? Are they simply saying sex is fun? You know, is that the point? Is that all there is? Like, we wouldn't have figured it out apart from this book? And I say, if that's the only point there is, then what does it really add to our knowledge? Because most of us were pretty suspicious of that in the first place. And other people go a little bit beyond that and say, actually, it is a manual. And I'm not kidding about this. The first time I encountered a serious study on the Song of Solomon, it was in a Sunday school, and there was this Sunday school curriculum laid out for us, and it would describe to us things like where it said, you know, let his right hand be under my head and his left arm around me, that this was the way Christian people, you know, got the job done. So it's really kind of a six easy steps to sexual fulfillment. I never did quite buy into that one. I thought, well, you know, maybe. So I said, you know, your hair is like a flock of goats, but it just didn't, it ruined the whole night, you know. Your teeth are like little sheep. No, that didn't work either. How old was I when I got married? Okay, it was an adult Sunday school, okay? Yeah. No, this is not third grade. Yes, I see. Sorry, I didn't set the context. I was married in seminary at an adult Bible fellowship, so to speak. Yeah. That's pretty funny. That's pretty funny. Oh, man. Okay, so let's go on from here. Let's go on and talk about what in the world this book is really all about. And in order to do that, you need to meet the cast of this reader's theater, as it were. How many people know what a reader's theater is? Just raise your hand for me. Okay. A reader's theater is simply where people will sit up front in a theater like on Sewell's and do an oral interpretation. So they kind of speak the parts, but you don't act them out. And I think that's kind of what this is supposed to serve as, because you can understand for obvious reasons you don't act this thing out. But there are players in the show. And so that's why we have this kind of little background. And there is the first major player, the groom slash husband. And I put it that way because at one point, he is the groom, or the fiancé, and then, of course, this thing happens over time, so later he is the husband, right? He is, in many ways, just like most weddings, the least important figure there, right? The most important one is the bride slash wife, and it really is her story. It's told from her perspective, and she tells her story after she has been married, and she tells her story to these, the daughters of Jerusalem, who are the young unmarried girls. I will ask you to do a reaction paper on this. And one guy who did it last time said, I kind of imagine this like a slumber party. And I think he was kind of right. Anybody here seen 13 going on 30? Come on, raise your hands. Yeah, okay. If you can imagine the older woman speaking to a bunch of younger girls who are unmarried around this slumber party, that's kind of the situation you have here with this older woman who has been through the whole process, says, okay, now I'm going to tell you what I wish someone had told me before I had gone through the whole thing. And that's kind of the situation because the main figures are these two, the bride or the wife, who is telling her story for the daughters of Jerusalem. Right? So, let's get right into it and take a look at it. Now, the only thing I ask you to do is to give me the benefit of the doubt and to hear me out for the whole period. Because this is a fairly complex book, and the story and the message builds, and it's more complex than you probably at first will think. You probably first think, I'm just going to say, make sure you stay a virgin, and that's good. All right, and it's a whole lot more complex than that. Right? There's a lot of nuances to it, and you got to let the whole thing develop. So don't tune me out, because I know this is an area that often is very personal. A lot of people feel very deeply. There's a lot of angst. There is a lot of emotion. There's a lot of guilt, and sometimes when your thoughts start running, you know, in those areas, it's easy to turn out and to forget. So please listen to the whole message, if you would, all right? So here's how we're going to start. She begins her message, and you can see here it is a conversation between the wife and the daughters of Jerusalem. chapter 1 and verse 2. She says, "Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes." And so she is speaking here to the daughters of Jerusalem about how much she loves her husband and how much she enjoys the physical part of their relationship. I won't go into detail here. We certainly will have time to do that in chapters 4 and 5, so we'll just kind of skip over some of this. She's talking about her body and how she didn't have time to prepare it as she wanted to, and some of her brothers were mean to her and made her work outside in the vineyards, and her skin got all dark and tanned. It's kind of funny how culture switches, isn't it? You know? It would be a good thing today, but not back then. So in the conversation, he looks at her and he says, "I liken you, my darling, to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of Pharaoh. Your cheeks are beautiful with earrings, your neck with strings of jewels," and on and on and on. So I don't think he's necessarily saying this, but this would be his part. So as she's speaking to these young girls, she's saying, "Here's how I feel about him, and this is the way he feels about me as well." And they go back and forth, and it starts to get fairly detailed here in verses 12 to chapter 2 and verse 6, a conversation between the couple, or at least one where she is reciting. And it gets pretty heavy. I won't describe all of it, but let me just pick it up a couple verses here, like verse 15. "How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful your eyes are doves. How handsome you are, my lover. Oh, how charming our bed is verdant." Now, if you don't have I should have mentioned this before. If you don't have a study Bible, this is going to be kind of hard to keep up with, because you can't tell who is speaking to whom in English. In Hebrew, the pronouns are masculine or feminine, so it's not just you, general, it's you, girl, or you, guy. So if you read those things in Hebrew, you can tell who is speaking to whom, and that's why a study Bible with headings is pretty helpful here. So the two are going back and forth, and they're saying things like verse 17, "Now, the beams of our house are cedars, our rafters are firs." And so she's simply describing how much she enjoys living at home, being married to this man. And in every way, it's very sensual in kind of a classic sense. You know, the senses are there. It smells good in the cedar house. It's beautiful in this big cedar house, and they live together, and she's just delighted with it all. She gets a little more detailed here in chapter 2 and says things like this in verse 3, "Like an apple tree among the forest of the trees is my lover among the young men. I delight to sit in his shade, and his fruit is sweet to my taste. He has taken me to the banquet hall, and his banner over me is love." Now, I'm not going to try to give a one-to-one correspondence for every one of those things, but I think you can figure it out. They're talking about making love here, and then how much they enjoy each other, I guess the only comment I would like to make is that I think if we really understood the sexually charged nature of this in the context, that "his banner over me is love" is probably not the song we would choose for the vacation Bible schoolers, you know, in the summertime. "Banner over me is love." That's again, it's not third grade material, is it? You know, not at all. So she goes on to say, "Strengthen me with raisins, refresh me with apples, for I am faint with love. His left arm is under my head, and his right arm embraces me." And so I can just imagine here, if in fact we are at a slumber party setting type thing, and she's going through and describing this stuff and says, "Oh, I'm faint with love, and my whole body can feel this, and his right arm is under my head." I imagine that the girls are just kind of, you know, dropping their tongues out of their mouths and going, you know, what is she going to say? Where is she going to stop? How far is this whole thing going to go? Maybe we have some curiosity, but I'm not sure I want to know all this. And so she keeps going right up to this point in verse 6, and then all of a sudden she stops and she makes this statement that she's going to make three times in the book. And it comes here under this soliloquy of the wife, and what she says is this: "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the wild does, do not stir up or awaken love until it is ready." Now, the question is, what exactly does she mean by this? And as you look at this book, I think you understand that every book has to be, words have to be understood within the context of the book. When you talk about love in this book, it's pretty clear that the love we're talking about is all that which goes on between man and woman, but especially, and most importantly, in this book at least, the physical part. And I think what she's saying is, don't you dare stir it up or awaken physical love until it is ready. Now, you say, okay, what does that mean, until it is ready? What does that mean? Don't get involved in things physical until you feel like it, until your hormones are racing. Well, what kind of a message would that be? Right? And as you read this in the rest of the context, I think what we can safely say as you read chapters 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and the rest of them, what she is saying is, don't you dare get involved physically or stir up things physically until the right time. Until it is ready, until God intends that it is ready. And the way she defines that in the book over and over again is until you are married. Alright? So, let me put this whole big thing together. What she's saying to the young girls at the slumber party is this: you know what? I really love being married to this man. I really love even the physical aspects of our relationship, and I love to make love to him, and it is all that you hope it will be. But don't you dare get involved in it until the right time. Right? So this is not the whole message, but this is the message up to this point. Back off. Don't get physically involved. That's what chapter 2 and verse 7 is saying. Now, as I said before, we're going to see this two other times that are very, very important. And I don't know how you feel about this or how you respond to this, but I certainly know that when married people would say that to me when I was single, I always kind of resented it. I don't know how you feel about it. But it always seemed like, well, yeah, that's easy for you to say. You're married, right? You're enjoying all the benefits of this. How can you say that to those of us who are not married? And I think she anticipates that. Because, you know, our response is easy for you to say, and she comes back then in 2:7 to 3:5 and says, well, let me tell you, we had every reason to want to get involved, but we didn't. Alright? So what we're going to see here in 2:7 to 3:5 is, well, yeah, it's easy for you to say don't get involved. She says, hold on. I'm not asking you to do anything I haven't already done myself. We had all kinds of reasons to want to be involved physically, but we weren't. Okay, so tell us about it. All right? Number one, he was physically attractive. Chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. Listen, my lover, look, here he comes, leaping across the mountains, bounding over the hills. My lover is like a gazelle or a young stag. And if you've ever watched deer or a gazelle in the wild, nothing is much more graceful or powerful. I remember watching a deer come up to an interstate fence once and thinking, oh, you know, the thing's in trouble now. And the deer just leaps over this 6-foot fence or 7-foot fence just as but with much grace and power as can be. And she says, this is what this guy is like. He's just a beautiful, graceful, powerful guy. He is physically attractive. But now look where we go. He is romantically attractive. Do you see how many verses are dedicated to this? All right, now, the point of this book is not to teach you, you know, how to be really attractive to somebody else, but there are a few things you can learn. So guys, some of you really need to listen up to this. Okay? Listen carefully. All right? We'll let the women decide whether or not you need to hear it as we go through here, but just trust me, guys, listen very carefully. Number one, he's romantically attracted to me because verses 10 to 13, he initiated the relationship and he invited me. Verse 10, my lover spoke and said to me, arise, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me. And it kind of talks about going out and walking through the countryside in a beautiful time, but verse 13 finishes with the same thing. Arise, come, my darling, my beautiful one, come with me. So he initiates the relationship and asks her to come with him. So let's just stop for a second and ask the ladies. Ladies, is this a good idea? Okay, now guys, you see, they're nodding their heads. So don't miss this, right? He initiated the relationship. He had some guts. He took some leadership. Yeah, he did that. All right. Verse 14, he desired to know me. I like this one. My dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the hiding places of the mountainside, show me your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. I really like this, because in this relationship, which is obviously, you know, eventually going to be very physically charged, what he is interested in here is talking with her, getting to know her. Let me hear your voice. I want to talk with you. I don't want to simply spend time with you where no one else is so I can have my way or do things we would be embarrassed about in public, but I want to talk with you and to know you. Verse 15, we resolve to avoid conflicts. Catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, our vineyards that are in bloom, and the idea is let's not let little irritations build up. Let's take care of things, and my commitment is to our relationship, and so I don't want anything to build up or to overshadow that. We want this personal relationship to develop. And then verse 16 and 17, we're mutually committed to each other. My lover is mine and I am his. And this next one is fairly poetic, and I'm not sure if I've got it right, but I think it's the idea. I always search for one like him. And verses 1 through 4, she says, I've been looking for a guy like this, and I couldn't find him, and eventually I found him, and I took him home and introduced him to my parents. And I think the idea is, you know, throughout my life, I dated a lot of turkeys. Right? Dated some guys that just weren't worth dating, but I didn't know I was young. And finally, I found a guy of character, and I said, yeah, this is the guy. So you add all these things up, and what you've got here are reasons why it would have been easy to get involved physically. Because he was romantically attractive. He was physically attractive. He wanted to know me. We resolved to avoid conflicts. And he was a man of character. And all of these things go together to make it even more tempting to get involved physically. And if you think it's difficult to not get involved physically when you're dating, wait till you get engaged. Wait till you find somebody who you know you want to spend the rest of your life with, and then see what the temptations are like, because it just gets harder, because it's so much easier to rationalize. And so what she's saying here is, we had every reason, but we didn't. And then in chapter 3 and verse 5, it's the same as it was in 2:7. So this whole section is bracketed with that. Back off. I adjure you, daughters, by the gazelles of the field and does of the field, do not arouse or do not awaken love until the right moment. All right? Now, that's not the whole point, but we're just getting started here. So she says, they say to her, okay, obviously you did this. Why are you telling us this? And she says, well, because it makes for a good marriage afterwards. In fact, it makes for a good wedding day. For example, let me show you this. The glory of a pure wedding, 3, 6 to 11. And what we're going to talk about here in verses 6 to 11 is, in fact, the wedding day. I know that, I believe, because verse 11 says, come out, you daughters of Zion, and look at King Solomon wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding. So 6 to 11 is about his wedding day, and I think what she's saying is this. I remember that day with absolute delight. In fact, I remember the first time I saw him on that day, verse 6. Who is this coming up from the desert like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices? It's Solomon in his carriage, and so she kind of sees him the first time, and there's this column of smoke from all the horses coming up behind him. And the whole idea is simply that she looks back on the day as a wonderful day. Now, I want to try to say this in a way that's not offensive and yet speaks the truth in love. What she's saying is, because we had a pure relationship before, the day of our wedding was a delightful day to look back on. And I'm not trying to lay guilt trips on people here at all, but you need to know that that's a really wonderful, wonderful thing to look forward to a wedding day and to do it correctly so that when you get there, it's a day of rejoicing. It was just a little less than a year ago, I walked my oldest down the aisle, and I suppose every dad loves his daughters, but I just have this special connection with my girls, and that was what I anticipated to be the absolute worst day of my entire life, when I had to give that beautiful daughter away to some young guy who didn't really know. Well, I won't go into it, but it's what I was anticipating, you know. As it turns out, it was a pretty good deal, and I think I'd do it again, but I just remember going down the aisle, and we had determined this is going to be a happy day. We were not going to cry. Okay, Dad? Okay. All right. So we're there at the end of the aisle, just before the music starts to play, and we're just having our own special time and, you know, looking at each other for the last time here. And we walked down the aisle, and I just didn't anticipate that halfway through the aisle, as they were all looking at her and all the attention was on her, that just this father's pride just welled up within me. And I was just so happy and so proud of her that she and Drew had done this right. And I was just so excited and happy for her, an emotion I didn't expect to have. But I think that's what this woman is saying too. Man, when you do this correctly, this can be a great day. Now, again, don't tune me out. If you've made mistakes in the past, I'm not trying to say you can't have a day like this. What we're talking about is the person with whom she's married. She has done this correctly. Your past doesn't have to define your future. All right? So let's go on. This is a great day. And in fact, it's a great night as well. So we're going to see that in chapter 4. The lovemaking of the wedding night. The two here, this is clearly their honeymoon night and their wedding night, and they talk about each other physically, and they go back and forth. Again, it's from a different culture, so it's a little hard to figure out. Verse 1, your hair is like a flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn. Okay, maybe she had white teeth, I don't know. And then it goes down and describes their various points, and I'm not going to go into detail here. But let me mention a few things, like verse 9. You stole in my heart, my sister, my bride. Now, I kind of like the different terms he uses there. My sister, my bride, all these terms of intimacy and closeness, and talks about their relationship. And then he says this, verse 11. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. Do you understand how he knows that? If you don't understand, I'm not going to tell you. All right. Verse 12. Now, this is the part that I do want to focus on a little bit. Notice what verse 12 says. You cannot miss this part. He says to her, "You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain." So you got this synonymous parallelism here. It's trying to say something three times just to make sure you don't miss it. I don't think anybody in the world can miss this if they read it. Do you see what it's saying? You are a garden locked up. You are a spring that's enclosed. You are a sealed fountain. What they're saying here is that this is the very first time these two have been together. All right? And then it goes on, and again, it speaks in these metaphorical terms. Verse 15, you're a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. Verse 16, awake north wind and come south wind, blow on my garden that its fragrance may spread abroad. Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits. Then chapter 5 and verse 1. I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride, I've gathered my myrrh, and goes on here. And again, what you see is very clearly the two have come together here and experienced the most intimate relationships of all human relationships, and it's done in a very discreet and clear way. But you know, this is the first time they have been together. So she wasn't fooling us before, you know, when she said, don't you dare get involved, because we didn't get involved either, and this is how it played out. Now, again, the whole message is a little complex, so we're not nearly there yet, so stay with me. There's some question about the very end of verse 1. Eat, O friends, and drink your fill, O lovers, about who is saying that. And my personal favorite is that these are the words of God, that God is the one who's looking down and saying, yeah, this is exactly how I intended it to be, and you guys enjoy each other and enjoy the intimacy and the ecstasy that comes from this relationship. But it doesn't stay that way because of the conflict. So here's what happens. Like every marriage between two sinners, there will be trouble. And this is a very significant central part of the message. There is a problem that happens almost immediately. And it's a very typical, understandable problem. Here's the way it goes. Verse 2. I slept, but my heart was awake. Listen, my lover is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one. So, you know, maybe after the honeymoon, maybe several weeks later, here's what's happening. She's in bed alone. The bedroom door is locked, and she is in that kind of dreamy state between, you know, being half awake and half asleep. And she says, I slept, but my heart was awake, and I heard him knocking. He's outside the bedroom, and the door is locked for whatever reason. And he says, open to me. And then he says, listen to it carefully so you can figure out what's going on. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one. You know, all these words of kind of flattery. And, you know, it's not just like, hey, open up the door. It's he has sort of an agenda here. All right. And he says, my head is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of the night. And she says, but I've taken off my robe. Must I put it on again? I have washed my feet. Must I soil them again? So do you understand what she's saying to him? I've got a headache, sweetheart. It ain't happening tonight. That's what she says to him, very clearly. I don't know, I got out of bed again, I have to wash my feet, or whatever. Okay, whatever. Verse 4. My lover thrust his hand through the latch opening. So he's fooling around with the door, trying to get it open. He can't get it open. And then it says, my heart, the woman, my heart began to pound for him. So I changed my mind. I arose to open for my lover, and my hands dripped with myrrh. And verse 6, I opened for my lover, but my lover had left. He was gone. My heart sank at his departure. So you got this big conflict. She says no. He gets mad, walks off in huff. Now they got this big conflict between the two of them. It happens, okay, in marriage. So what are they going to do? Well, she attempts to resolve the problem. And because we don't have much time, let me just summarize it quickly. She goes and she searches for him. Some things happening here I don't fully understand. She's searching for him at night, and the watchmen of the city don't know who she is, and they kind of beat her up, and I'm not sure why that happens, unless it's just part of, you know, one bad thing leads to another. But eventually, she is thinking about him, and he begins to think about her, and he finds her, and the two come back together. And there's this reconciliation of the couple in chapter 6, verses 4 to 13. And by the time you get to the end of it, verse 12 says, before I realized it, my desire set me among the royal chariots of my people. So they are back together. Now, what is the point? The point of it, I think, up to this section is simply this. Not if you only knew what we were talking about in here. Banner over me as well. The point is this, that these two have gone through conflicts as every married couple will do. But the beauty of it is that the conflicts didn't sink their ship. The beauty is that because they had a relationship which was based upon personal relationship and they loved each other, then they got through the difficulties in marriage and survived. And this is the big idea here. The contrast, of course, is that if you have a relationship which is simply based on mutual physical attraction and you don't build a deep relationship, when you get into those rough waters, your ship will sink because you don't have a relationship upon which to base this marriage. So they make it through, and not only do they make it through, but they thrive. Let me tell you, they thrive, all right? Making up is the best part here. The couple express their love for one another. Chapter 7, verse 1 to chapter 8 and verse 3. Now, if you just glance at this, you will notice very quickly how beautiful your sandaled feet, O prince's daughter. Your graceful legs are like jewels, the work of a craftsman's hands, your navel's a rounded goblet, on and on and on. And if you read through chapter 7, you say, wait a minute, we've seen this before. And you'd be absolutely right. Where do you see the two of them describing each other's bodies in great detail? It's like the wedding night, exactly. It's the wedding night. But there's a difference between the wedding night stuff, which was in chapter 4, and the reconciliation stuff, which is here in chapter 7. And the difference is that this one is much longer. Now, think about that for a moment and see if you can't make some observations about it. In which spot are they more desperately in love, even in a physical way? The further they go, the more these two fall in love, even physically. I think that's a pretty amazing statement. I will never forget. Let me just tell you very quickly one of the revelations of my young boyhood, I suppose, and I was, you know, I don't know, 14 or 15, and I was watching the NFL on Sunday afternoon. And at that time, which is a long time ago, there were these two quarterbacks that were kind of polar opposites. They were both Super Bowl winning quarterbacks, Roger Staubach of the Dallas Cowboys, and Joe Namath of the New York Jets. And Joe Namath was known for being this playboy type guy, and Roger Staubach was a squeaky clean Christian. And they were interviewing Roger Staubach and about the difference between these two guys. And I don't know if they were making fun of him or what. And he kind of stopped the interview and he says, I just want to say one thing, and that is, I enjoy sex just as much as Joe Namath does. And that kind of caught my attention, because I wasn't used to hearing those words way back then, especially in the NFL on Sunday. I enjoy sex just as much as Joe Namath does, but I just do it with one woman. I thought, whoa, I never heard that in church. Pretty interesting. And the more I read this book, the more I realize what this is saying is, you know what, this couple gets in love more and more, not only spiritually and emotionally, but physically as well. And that kind of puts a lie to a lot of what you might hear in the rumor mill or in the culture that says monotony and monogamy, yeah, there's a relationship between those two. No. These two love each other more as they go. So let's keep going here and take a look at towards the end what happens. You have a final word of counsel concerning moral purity, chapter 8 and verse 4, which says, once again, daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. And the reason for that, the theme is given here once again, is simply this. Because of the uncontrollable power of love. Chapter 8, verses 5 through 7. It says this. Place me like a seal over your heart, for love is as strong as death, and jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like a blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love. And I think the big idea is this. Number one, don't you dare get involved in physical relationship for the right time. And one of the reasons you ought not to is because it's so uncontrollable. Because you can't control it. It is a universal fallacy of the human mind to think, oh, we know when to stop. How many friends have you heard say that, or how many times have you said that perhaps in the past? Oh yes, I really like this guy, I really like this girl, and yeah, we kind of get involved in but we know when to stop. Oh really? Really? You can let the fire go in the house and somehow you can stop the house from burning down. Because the way that goes, it just takes a matter of time before it plays itself out. You go this far, and then you step a little bit over that line, and then a little bit over that line, and pretty soon you get caught and you say, man, I had no idea that was going to happen. Yeah? Because it's uncontrollable. It's supposed to be that way. That's why it's such a beautiful, wonderful gift, because it's absolutely uncontrollable. It's supposed to be uncontrollable. You can't contain except inside the place where it's supposed to be, which is a marriage covenant. Like a fire in a furnace is helpful. You let the fire out of the furnace and it destroys the whole house. Don't get involved because you can't control it. And then I love this. There's this understanding response to the daughters of Jerusalem. And it's like the girls in the slumber party now look back and say, okay, we think we know what you're saying here. If we're catching it, is this what you're saying? So they make this application. And what they say is this, verses 8 and 9, and I beg your maturity here with me for a second. So we have a sister, and her breasts are not yet grown. Okay, so we got this little sister who's 10 or 11. What shall we do for our sister for the day she is spoken for? So you catch it here? I mean, this is exactly the issue. We got a little sister. What are we going to do so that when she gets old enough to be married, she will be ready for that day? What can we do for her? Here's what we will do. If she is a wall, we will build towers of silver on her. But if she is a door, we will enclose her with panels of cedar. What are they saying? Well, when you take a look at a city, what do walls do? Walls protect. Walls keep things out. And what it's saying is, if she is a wall, we will build towers on her. Towers are what you do to strengthen walls. So if we find that she doesn't let boys in, that she is pure, then we will honor her, and we will protect her, and we will encourage her. But if she is a door, we will enclose her with panels of cedar. Do you catch that? If she is a door, we will build our own doors around her to barricade her with panels of cedar that won't rot. Like, you know, if we find a tendency in our little sister to be loose, we'll go out on dates with her until she's 35. You know, we're going to do whatever is necessary to protect her and to barricade her so that she doesn't get involved in this. And they get it exactly right. She says, yes, you've got my point. Don't arouse physical love until the proper moment, which is marriage. And here is one of the ways you do it. You help someone start when they're young and say, here are the dangers. Don't get involved. And you encourage them if they remain strong, and you barricade them if they fall. And then they finish here. And again, she says, I am a wall, and my breasts are like towers. The point is, she's grown up now, but before this, she was clearly a wall, and that's why it says, I've become in his eyes like one bringing contentment. Now, where are we here? again, are we simply saying if you are not a virgin, you have blown it? And the answer is no here. And it's more complex than that. What it's saying is simply this, that when you come to developing a relationship that's going to be for marriage, one of the stupidest things you can do is to let the physical relationship get wrapped up in it. Because when you do, you will lose your mind and you will do things you wouldn't normally do, but more importantly than that, you will not build that marriage on a personal relationship. Because the hormones get racing so much that you can't see straight, and it takes over the time and the investment that would have been built into building a personal relationship. Now, let me picture it something like this. What a lot of people will do, and not because anybody's malicious, but just because unless somebody tells you, the culture just encourages you to do this, you put the physical relationship on the bottom. You get involved, you start dating, you go further and you go further, and the physical relationship is the bottom, and it becomes the basis for a marriage covenant right here. And then you say, okay, after we get married, then we'll build the personal relationship. And the trouble with that, according to this book, is at least twofold. Number one, you may or may not be deeply compatible. Oh, I wish I could tell you this. Because you're not married, or most of you are not married, and most of you don't have friends who are married, you probably don't run in these circles, because people don't like to broadcast this. But trust me, after you get married, you will have lots and lots of friends probably, and I hope it's not you, who will say, you know what? We got married, and after 6 months, we realized we didn't really have a personal relationship, and I woke up and I said, I don't even know who you are. And I'm not sure I even like you. I can't tell you how devastating that is and how often it happens. How could you not know each other? You dated for a year. Well, because, and the truth is, because the physical relationship was so dominating, that's what took over, and there was no place for the personal relationship to really develop. And the second thing I want to say is to, especially to you guys, because we've talked a lot about male leadership, and I, the women are culpable too here, but I especially want to put this on the guys. But let me say this. If this is how you've arranged your dating relationship, so the physical's down here, and then all of a sudden you get married and want to work on this up here, number two, you won't have the personal integrity or the spiritual walk to build an intimate personal relationship with another person. You get involved physically with your girlfriend or your fiance, and then once you're married to her, you say, oh, and I want to start leading you spiritually now. How in the world are you ever going to say that? And what's she going to say back to you? Oh, so all of a sudden now you want to be spiritual? All of a sudden before you were very selfish, you ruined your purity and ruined my purity and led us into things that we knew were wrong. And now we feel guilty and horrible about, but now all of a sudden you want to make things right. So why the change now? The truth is that this book says you ought to switch those, and that in fact the personal relationship ought to come down here, and the physical relationship ought to be saved and secured up there within the bounds of the marriage covenant. And that when you focus on the personal relationship down here, you build this marriage on respect and self-control and integrity, and you keep the physical where it belongs in the bounds and the protection of the furnace of a marriage covenant. G.K. Chesterton said it this way many, many years ago. Every man who knocks on the door of a brothel is looking for God. That might seem a little shocking to you, but what he was simply saying was that what we think we're looking for is sex, and what we're really looking for is intimacy, and the kind of intimacy which you and I are designed for from God Himself. Because the truth is that you were designed from the ground up. I like that phrase. It reminds me of Genesis 1. You were designed from the ground up for intimacy with God, first of all, and with another person in the bonds of a covenant. You realize that when God said, let us make man in our image, He was talking about, we got these three eternally relating persons who are designed to relate to each other. And we're going to make male and female designed to relate for each other. So this idea of intimacy and relationship is built within you. It's at the center of you. Why in the world do you think we like to talk about sex so much? Why does that consume our thoughts so much of the day? Because that's the way God designed you. But it's not just the outward sex, it is the intimacy that comes from a relationship first with God and second with another person in the bounds of a marriage covenant. Listen to the words of Dallas Willard here when he says, "The rightness of sex is tied to a solemn and public covenant for life between two individuals. As sexual arousal and delight is a response to the gift of a uniquely personal intimacy with a whole person that each partner has conferred in enduring faithfulness upon the other. Intimacy is the mutual mingling of souls who are taking each other into themselves to ever-increasing depths. The truly erotic is the mingling of souls. Intimacy is the spiritual hunger of the human soul, and we cannot escape it. This has always been true and remains true today." We keep hammering the sex button in the hope that a little intimacy might finally dribble out, but in vain. For intimacy only comes within the framework of an individualized faithfulness within the kingdom of God. Now, when you talk about physical relationship, I suppose you have to say, you know, where do we draw the line? And I hesitate to do that just because people can legalistically look at a line. But let me just tell you what the text says. And the text says, don't arouse physical love. So that's pretty much the answer if you're willing to take it. You don't do things that arouse physical love. What does it do? What kind of things do you do that arouse physical love? Well, you're pretty much smart enough to figure that out. Well, we can kiss and not arouse. Well, if you can kiss and not arouse, you need lessons in kissing, okay? Because that's pretty big arousal. There are kisses. I kiss my mom, I kiss my daughters, and I kiss my wife, but I kiss them very differently. And there, let me just say this again very, very clearly and frankly to you. If you think that oral sex is not sex, then you and Bill Clinton have graduated from the same school of ethics. This is not something you try to get around. This is something you look at. This is such classic wisdom literature because it does not say God's going to get you if you don't do it this way. What it says is more like the, hey, if you really want to live well, do it like this. This is just such a wise, good way to live. And the reason I think it rings so true is because relationships are founded in the soul and they're only celebrated in the body. That's the message of this book. And you would do well to be the Boaz and the Ruth and to rise above our culture. Have a good day, everybody. I'll see you Friday.